We're up against products that have been designed to be, you know, almost addictive. In the 1960s, the sugar industry created the Sugar Research Foundation. And all they did was fund researchers who published influential reviews that downplayed concerns about sugar and instead focused attention on dietary fat as a primary cause of heart disease, because there were starting to be linkages between sugar and heart disease, and that would be bad for their industry. So then what do we have? We have the low-fat craze in the 90s and things like low-fat Lunchables. That's still not good for you, right? And Splenda and all these things that we're now finding maybe have some real impact on our gut health and our gut microbiome. How do companies make low-fat products taste better? Because let's be honest, they don't taste very good. They add sugar to them. So in order to maintain taste and marketability, they add sugar to low-fat products. And so now we see the demonization of fat and a low-fat craze, sugar being added to products, and more heart disease. And it's not helping.
The tension between profits and public health and health equity isn't new, but we're only now beginning to unravel the human costs borne by individuals and communities across the world. In 2023, in a series published in the medical journal The Lancet, researchers spanning 15 countries and 6 continents revealed how massive commercial interests have used science, marketing, and policymaking in ways that prioritized economic growth over health and wellness. Researchers' most stunning conclusion: that 4 industries, tobacco, ultra-processed foods, fossil fuel, and alcohol, are responsible for at least a third of global deaths, 19 million each year, can defy imagination. But the smaller by comparison revelations that have also emerged, a 2023 study linking lower breastfeeding rates to marketing and research sponsored by the infant formula industry, or a 2025 study finding that vape stores in Washington, D.C. cluster near schools and universities, beg the question: how much do we really understand about the for-profit businesses working to quietly shape so many of the choices we make every day? Whatever emerging research ultimately reveals, the battle for health equity now hits uncomfortably close to home for us all. Its face is no longer a decades-long struggle over global access to HIV and AIDS medications. It's also what you see when you walk into your grocery store, and how massive amounts of time, money, and human expertise developed over decades can have a positive or negative effect on health and society. Welcome to Living Healthy Together. We've got a special one for you today. We're talking about the commercial determinants of health. If you don't know what those are, everything from sugary drinks to addictive substances like alcohol and tobacco have third-party, private, commercial interests behind it. From the development of these products to how they're marketed and how they live in our everyday lives and our social consciousness as a nation, these are the commercial determinants of health. Activities in the private sector that positively or negatively affect your health and your ability to make informed decisions about how to live your life and how to stay healthy and well. It's a big topic, it's unwieldy, and joining me today to kick it off is Eva Zaret, the director of the Central Vermont Prevention Coalition and an expert in public health. Eva, thanks for joining us today. I obviously gave a little background here, but this is a really big and complex topic. What am I missing? What do people need to know about what these things are?
Yeah, thanks for even doing this episode, Phil. This is sort of a new area of research, but I think that's why it's really important to talk about it. So I think I'll spend just a minute or two sort of level setting us on the history so that we can understand how we got here. So for much of the 20th century, health was really viewed through what we call in public health the biomedical model. So it was understood as a result of genetics, individual behaviors, and like whether or not you had access to medical care. And so we just felt like if we could just improve healthcare services develop better treatments, better understand viruses and bacteria, then we could achieve better health outcomes. And so a lot of amazing things happened because of that, of course, vaccines, antibiotics, and whatnot. But then in the 70s, 80s, and then really in the 90s, we realized that health is shaped by broader social and economic conditions. And so there's some really influential frameworks that came out in the early 90s that said, okay, actually our social relationships, our living and working conditions, education, housing, employment, these sort of like broader economic and environmental conditions have a huge influence on our health, and actually more than our access to healthcare and our individual genetics. And those became known as the social determinants of health. But now, like you said, we're taking it one step further to talk about the commercial determinants of health. So the social determinants explain the conditions in which we live and work and age and whatnot. And the commercial determinants of health explain the forces that created those conditions in the first place. Corporate practices, marketing strategies, product design, political influence, business incentives, and all of these things affect our health in ways every single day that we don't even realize. So it's building on concepts that people may have heard before, but it's new. Even though we encounter it every day, it's a little bit of a new concept. And I think that people are going to find it really fascinating today.
It incorporates so many different things. It's so complex. And like you said, it incorporates everything from product design, which I think a lot of people put to the side, right? Even if you know that a soda or a snack cracker or a chip is designed by a company, it's hard to internalize how many millions of dollars and hundreds of people have worked on that, and the scientific expertise that's brought to bear, and the many different things that go into how does this food taste? How does it feel in your mouth? What's it like to eat it? All of these things impact your ability to eat in moderation, to choose not to eat. So it's incredibly impactful. It's incredibly complex. Is there a way to ground people in an example? I love food science, and I wonder if that's maybe a good place to start, because again, the way that these things are designed to make us eat and to affect our eating habits, really fascinating. So give us an example, if you would, of how this plays out in practice.
Yes, I think a concrete example is perfect. So let's talk about food by way of talking about cigarettes. So a common strategy in the private industry is to frame health and environmental harms as matters of personal responsibility and individual choice. And that's so that they can avoid regulation. So for decades, we all know this, right? The tobacco industry promoted cigarettes while there was mounting evidence that they were extremely bad for you. Funded research so that they could sort of cast doubt on the scientific consensus that was coming, delay that regulation, like I mentioned. Addiction and disease was mounting, but ultimately their message was about this is, you know, individual choice and freedom. Today, we have a lot of regulations around tobacco and tobacco use and nicotine, which has had some really amazing outcomes in terms of health. But what people don't realize is that tobacco companies became incredibly sophisticated at understanding human behavior. So like you just mentioned, they invested enormous resources into figuring out what do people want? How do they make decisions? What motivates them? How can we create products that are designed to maximize appeal and maximize consumption? And that expertise migrated directly into the food industry, like you alluded to. So in 1985, Philip Morris, tobacco, cigarettes, acquired General Foods, which merged with Kraft Foods, which we're all familiar with, Kraft Mac and Cheese. And during that period, one of the company's biggest success stories was Lunchables. At first glance, Lunchables is kind of a simple product. If you're not familiar, if you didn't grow up in the 90s, it's cheese, crackers, and processed meats in a little box with like a plastic foil kind of thing that pulls off, right?
And if you did grow up in the 90s, you will remember the desire, the strongest desire to be one of the kids that had these at the lunch table. They were all you wanted to take for lunch if you brought your lunch to school.
So I had a different experience because I had a public health nurse as a mom. And so these were banned in my house and she was on a crusade against them. And I was embarrassed because she would go into schools and she would like rail against Lunchables. But she was right. She was right about Lunchables. She's right about margarine. She's right about Teflon. So here's what happened with Lunchables. So this simple, it's just crackers, processed cheese, and processed meats. It's not good for you. But this is a very recent sort of breaking story. All these internal company documents came out that showed just how much research went into designing this product. They spent hours doing extensive focus groups that observed children interacting with multiple product prototypes, like 17 different prototypes of Lunchables, and tried to figure out which ones were most appealing to kids and what was motivating them. And they realized that kids are really strongly motivated by autonomy. They wanted to feel independent. They wanted to feel grown up and in control. So they designed Lunchables so that kids could assemble it themselves. They could put the cheese and the crackers and the meats wherever they wanted, and they could stack them in different combinations and like play with their food before eating it. So it's described as like blurring the line between food and a toy. And then they also studied parents, especially working moms. They carefully engineered the packaging so that the transparent windows on top, so parents could see what was inside, and the marketing elements of it designed to make the product feel like it was a thoughtful choice and that you weren't like taking a shortcut to give this to your kid, instead of like cutting up cheese and putting some crackers in a lunch, that you were buying this product.
That is so sophisticated. It's simultaneously so sophisticated and nefarious, right? Because as a parent, I feel such a strong desire as a parent to make the best choices for my son because he can't make it himself. What does he want? He wants a sprinkle cookie,
yeah.
But I need to give him something nutritious. If you listen to the show before, you'll know my biggest thing, the thing that I've probably said more than anything else, is I'm excited to give you agency. I'm excited to give you information and ways to make an impact on yourself. This is the exact opposite. They are taking away your ability to make informed decisions.
Yeah, that's right. But it's all sold to you as freedom and personal choice, right? Because that's what we all want, and companies know that. And so they design their products, the packaging, the marketing, all of that is designed to make you feel like that's what you're achieving by buying this product that's probably not very good for you. So let's keep going with this. Companies love to do this. They create a product and then they create a better for you product. So they did this with cigarettes. They created cigarettes and then they created lower nicotine cigarettes. Still not good for you, right? They did the same thing with Lunchables. They created Lunchables, and then consumer preferences were shifting towards low-fat foods in the 90s. Ugh, God, the 90s were really rough for food.
Oh, the poor 90s. The poor 90s.
And we can talk about sugar in a little bit. I think that it would be really fascinating to so hold this thread. So again, Philip Morris drew on their expertise through the cigarette business. So scientists who had worked on maintaining flavor in those modified tobacco products with the lower nicotine were involved in helping create food products that remained appealing to eat after the fat was removed.
Human ingenuity at its best and at its worst. It must have been awful and amazing to be a food scientist in the 90s.
Yes, I totally agree. So in terms of, you know, a concrete example, I think that's a perfect one. And so now the question that we ask now is, why do kids love ultra-processed foods? Of course they do. They're not going to spend the money to create a product that people aren't going to eat. And then we're not asking the question, how were these products designed, tested, and marketed? Why are they so appealing? And why isn't there outrage over them?
We have to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with Eva and more on the answers to these questions, emerging research on these global health impacts, and other revelations that may surprise you about how a focus on profits impacts everyone's ability to make informed decisions about their health and wellness. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. We're talking with public health expert Eva Zaret. of CVMC today about how commercial interests impact public, community, and individual agency when it comes to health and wellness. Before we move on, if you're a news junkie like I am, there's some really interesting reporting about Lunchables. I can't remember the publication, but there was an extensive long-form article many years ago about Lunchables and about the food scientists that worked on Lunchables and the man, the individual that is credited with actually creating it as a concept. If I can find it, we'll link it in the podcast description of this episode. If it's there, I highly encourage you to read it. It's an incredible read, and it will show you, yet again, this dichotomy, these incredibly skilled and dedicated people that are working in an industry that maybe or probably definitely doesn't have everybody's best interests at heart. And these are the people that are feeding us.
Well, I think it's interesting that you even just went through that thought process of maybe, probably, definitely. 1,000%, a company has one goal, and that is to make a profit. There are certainly companies that have a strong social mission or are doing the right thing, and like there's certified B Corp, you know, companies that have to follow certain guidelines and they can sort of achieve the status. But ultimately, as consumers, we have to realize that the bottom line is about money and making a profit.
I love food. I am either eating or I'm thinking about eating. Those are my two states of being. But I also understand, and we're trying to help spread the word that and reinforce that you have to be your own best advocate. These companies are not here advocating for you. They're not thinking about your best interests because that's not their job.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the issue is that there's a misalignment between profit incentives and health outcomes. And often our health is what's at stake here. And in public health, we've used a misinformed strategy for a long time, which is what we tried to create fear, use fear as a motivator in people to change their behavior. So we just tried to make tobacco or alcohol or ultra-processed foods or whatever it is as scary as possible, thinking that that was going to motivate people to change their behavior. And there are rare times that fear as a motivational factor can be effective, but companies are not scaring us into eating their products or buying their products or whatever it is. They would never do that. Even pharmaceutical companies, when they're talking about a horrible disease and the medication that they've created to address it, and then they're talking about all the side effects, they're showing people living their best lives, right? Like these people couldn't be happier. They're frolicking on a beach. They're not scaring you into taking this medication. They're selling you the life that could be. And so we really need to change our approach in public health to not be focused on fear so much as to sell what the possibility is of the other choice. But we're up against products, like I said, that have been designed to be, you know, almost addictive. So let's go back to sugar for a little bit. Is that okay?
I'm living this every single day. Sprinkle donuts, sprinkle cookies, period. He will dip anything that he can get his hands on into maple syrup.
Mm-hmm.
So sugar, let's talk about it. And where do you want to start, right? I'm fine with diving headlong into it and saying, addictive or not? That's the keynote question here, right? Is how addictive is this stuff? It feels really addictive from the perspective of a parent.
Yeah, totally. And I think, you know, I'm assuming that you have parents listening and that it's something that we are faced with all the time is we want to make good choices for our kids, but we want to avoid some of the food trauma that we probably experienced in the 90s, right? And like break some of these cycles. And so we're trying really hard to do our best. So let me illuminate some things for people. So many good examples within the food industry. So we'll talk about, instead of a product, we're going to talk about how they can sort of control the narrative. In the 1960s, the sugar industry created the Sugar Research Foundation. And all they did was fund researchers who published influential reviews that downplayed concerns about sugar and instead focused attention on dietary fat as a primary cause of heart disease, because there were starting to be linkages between sugar and heart disease, and that would be bad for their industry. So then what do we have? We have the low-fat craze that we just talked about in the 90s and things like low-fat Lunchables. That's still not good for you, right? And Splenda and all these things that we're now finding maybe have some real impact on our gut health and our gut microbiome. How do companies make low-fat products taste better? Because let's be honest, they don't taste very good. They add sugar to them. So in order to maintain taste and marketability, they add sugar to low-fat products. And so now we see the demonization of fat and a low-fat craze, sugar being added to products, and more heart disease. And it's not helping, right?
And then you have this privately funded science, or is it actually pseudoscience, that's actually saying fat is the problem, not sugar, and no one's the wiser, no one's capable of making a decision that's good for their cardiovascular health.
Yeah, exactly. So what stems from this is the anti-diet movement. So the 90s, we talked about how that was kind of a difficult time for food. And there were so many diets that you could go on, and Weight Watchers and all of these things that, again, personal responsibility. You have to stand up in front of a group of people and get weighed and see how much, you know, weight you lost that week. Like, there were some really difficult approaches to nutrition and health.
You would think that at some point through the course of just pure human experience, we would have grown out of that model. And I know Weight Watchers isn't as big now as it was before, but when you realize that they actually further commercialized the Weight Watchers system into shows like The Biggest Loser. Now it's not just go to your local Weight Watchers meeting and stand up in front of those people and get weighed. It's go on TV and get weighed in front of the entire world and do it that way. So are we really learning anything?
Well, we did learn. Hopefully, maybe this podcast will spark a nationwide movement. But yes, to your point, I think people finally realized that this was really unacceptable. And so there was sort of this anti-diet movement that started, and it gained popularity, especially among younger generations like ours. Things like health at all sizes and intuitive eating that pushed back on this narrative about thinness as equating to health, right? And so I think at their heart, these movements are really valuable. And I think listening to your body, checking in, your internal hunger cues, like accepting your body where it's at, body positivity, which I think body neutrality actually is great. If we just didn't focus or talk about anybody's body, it's probably the better thing to do.
Good luck with that. If you figure out how to make that movement get off the ground, you let me know.
Okay, we'll be the next one. But of course, who loves this concept? Major food companies. They immediately recognized this opportunity. And so instead of positioning themselves against the movement, they just incorporated all of that language and messaging into their own marketing. And so an amazing expose in NPR found that food companies like General Mills partnered with social media influencers and dietitians who promoted anti-diet messaging. So they reviewed thousands and thousands of social media posts by dietitian influencers. And the majority of these dietitian influencers who had anti-diet messages were paid for by food and beverage companies. And so, you know, with intuitive eating, for example, the idea is that maybe you don't serve the cookie after lunch, maybe you serve it with lunch. And then kids don't have these arbitrary rules about food, like I have to eat all my food in order to have my cookie, like just serve it together and they can choose to eat the cookie first or not. So then the food industry just jumped on this. And so then you have these influencer dietitians who are often moms just like pouring Oreos into like a breakfast cereal bowl. And they're just like, it's part of a complete breakfast. And it's so wild. But we feel so much guilt as parents, like we just both just talked about what to serve our kids and how to do it. And so the messaging from companies is not, our food's not bad. Like, no, it's actually okay to eat it. It's just, you don't need to feel guilty about it. Just, you can have it. Then General Mills funded research into food shaming that opposed front of package nutrition labels. So public health advocates wanted to put nutrition labels on the front of packages that would identify foods that were high in sugar or sodium or saturated fat. And so General Mills said, well, if you do that, you're going to cause mental health problems. You're going to make people feel bad and isolated. And so then this didn't happen. So instead of helping consumers be informed about what kind of products they're putting in their bodies, they're taking away that information for you to make an informed choice, but selling it to you as empowerment, freedom from judgment.
And again, there are so many facets of this that are genius. It's ingenious to lean into something that could be harmful to your business model and find a way to tweak your business model to ride that movement to more profitability. And it's also good to support anti-body shaming and to support people being able to make decisions about what they eat and to have mental health. But when you couple that with a business interest,
yeah,
and you make the point of doing that, the reason for doing that, that you want to sell these foundationally unhealthy things to people, not in a above board way, but in a way that they don't even realize what's going on. That flies in the face of what we tell ourselves everybody should be able to do, which is walk into a store, understand what you're buying, and be able to make a decision. You can buy healthy stuff. You can buy unhealthy stuff. You can have the diet that works for you and live with the consequences, live with the results of what you're doing and have opportunities to do better if you want to. But you can't do that if you're making decisions based on faulty information or not enough information.
Yeah, exactly. And here's the other thing. I even want to like shift the conversation away from the individual, because when the problem is framed entirely as a matter of personal responsibility, this is always what they do. It's personal responsibility about whether and how much you eat, whether you smoke or drink, right? Drink responsibly. Slogan that the alcohol industry came up with. That's not added by the federal government.
And let's pause there for a second, because you were on our alcohol use disorder episode and we talked about this very briefly. How are you supposed to ingest a product responsibly when the emerging research is showing more and more clearly that there is no level at which you can do that?
Right.
Right?
Yes.
Gamble responsibly. Drink responsibly. You can't do it.
Right.
It's advice that can never be fulfilled.
Yeah, exactly. And so when they do that, we focus on changing individuals. And the questions we ask are why? Why do people want to drink? You know, why do they eat these ultra-processed foods instead of looking upstream and saying, why aren't we regulating industry on these things that are so harmful? And we're really just talking about products today and like a little bit about marketing, but there's so much more in terms of policy that we can and should talk about. If we could get up there, then we can shape choices long before an individual ever makes a decision. What I find so fascinating about all of this, because it's these forces that are basically hidden in plain sight. So the goal is not to eliminate personal responsibility. It's to recognize that responsibility exists within environments that are deliberately designed to get you to do something, and you're not even really aware of it. These powerful interests are at play. So when you walk into a store and products are placed on the shelf, there's a reason why a product is where it is. Nothing is by chance.
It's curated, right?
Yeah.
That's the word. It's curated. A food company can pay a grocery company for the particular placement of their product within the store.
Oh.
So it is all manufactured. You're not going into a store that's been specially designed for your community. All of those things are placed in a specific way, or many of them are placed in a specific way and in a specific location to get you to purchase them.
Yes.
That's the point.
Yes, exactly. Look at what's eye level, but then look at what's down lower and what's above, right? You and I have talked a lot about like, what would we want someone to take away from this conversation? And I think that it's that if you can start to look at the world through this lens, you'll see this recurring pattern across industries. You'll see how the narratives are created, how responsibility is shifted to you as the individual, how regulation is resisted. The costs then are transferred to communities, families, taxpayers, and the healthcare system. And so I'm not trying to tell people what to think or what to do. I'm just trying to get us to all see the water that we're swimming in. Because I think that if you can see those influences more clearly, then we can have a more honest conversation about what creates health, what undermines it, what kind of community do we want to like live in, what do we want our community to look like moving forward?
We're going to continue this conversation, but we have to take a quick break right now. We'll be back with more from Eva right after this. Welcome back to Living Healthy Together. We're here with public health expert Eva Zaret of CVMC, talking about corporate interests and the massive amounts of scientific expertise, time, and money that go into chipping away at your ability to make informed decisions about your health. I'm going to go back to food science because, again, this is one of the most interesting genres in terms of health and wellness and science, in my opinion. If you think about something as simple as a cheesy poof, that lives in the cultural consciousness because of South Park and because they're delicious, obviously. But what maybe you don't know is that they're designed specifically that way because they melt in your mouth and your brain doesn't tell your stomach that you're full. So if you find yourself sitting there and eating cheesy poofs or eating whatever version of these things that you're eating, you just keep going and going, I can eat a whole bag of those. Why is that? It's because there's science behind what your mind is telling your stomach or what your stomach is telling your mind that leads to you making a decision. It's just really incredible to me the amount of science and thought and money that goes into designing our food on this level. It's really fascinating and scary all at the same time.
We probably don't have time for this, but there's such another good example about plastic. Plastic is another, you know, we're hearing a lot about microplastics these days and the effects that they have in our bodies. And I feel this is apparent as well, similar to food and sugar and what choices I'm giving to my child. How do I cut down on the amount of plastic that we have in our home? Don't microwave things in plastic. I got rid of all of our plastic containers. I don't cook with anything, you know, any plastic like cooking utensils. All that to say that I think that plastic is really top of mind for people these days. And we are so, especially in Vermont, we're so diligent about our recycling. Like if I go somewhere that's not recycling, I'm going to bring my recycling home with me, right?
You're such a good egg, Eva. You're such a good egg.
We feel this, like, at least I do. And I think this is true in Vermont. Like we really want to do the right thing and we really want to recycle. And we have, you know, Green Up Day. It's a part of our culture here. So let me talk a little bit about plastic and recycling. In the 50s, in the 40s, and then into the 50s, Americans were starting to be really upset with the amount of litter and trash and single-use plastic that they were seeing in products. And companies got nervous about this because that's an opportunity to regulate. So I think that's another takeaway. Like, where are the opportunities to regulate, right, and show up in those spaces? So in the early 50s, the American Can Company and the Owens Illinois Glass Company and some other companies started Keep America Beautiful. This is a nonprofit that they started.
So Keep America Beautiful is a corporate interest cloaked in a nonprofit? I had no idea.
Yes, it is. That glass company later owns Dixie Cup Company, single-use little tiny cups that you just throw away. So they created the Keep America Beautiful nonprofit to keep their own interests at heart. And so the Advertising Council helped to make ads for Keep America Beautiful. They had done, you know, like Smokey the Bear for the U.S. Forest Service. So they had done some really powerful stuff that stuck with people. Again, only you can prevent forest fires, right? But why is the world becoming so much drier and forest fires becoming so much more prevalent? And so they decided that Keep America Beautiful, their ad campaign should be a lot like the Smokey the Bear campaign ads, and it should tell people that their own choices solve the problems. And so they created the Crying Indian ad, which was a public service announcement that aired in the 70s that showed an actor who is in Native American attire, so Italian American, I think, who played this person, and crying as you see people throwing garbage out of their cars and sort of like at him. And so who immediately has become villainized in this ad campaign it's individuals. You are now responsible for being the ones that stop all of this litter, not companies to create products that, you know, don't require so much packaging or whatever it is.
What an effective thing, because I do this all the time. You're walking on a beach, it's your vacation week, you're relaxing, you're unplugged from work, you see some litter. What jerk did that? What jerk sullied my beautiful beach, right? It's automatically the individual. It's one person that did this.
And it was probably plastic, right? It was probably like a plastic bottle or something like that, because throwaway bottles are cheaper. And the companies behind Keep America Beautiful didn't want the government to pass laws that would cost them money by creating drinks that needed to be in reusable bottles, right? And so then they have voters looking at the ad and thinking, oh, pollution, people make pollution. And I think the slogan was like, people started pollution, people can stop it. I mean, it doesn't get any more clear to them.
My God.
So
oh my God.
They just make litter something that's ugly and about poor citizenship. So going back to like this sort of cultural feeling that we have, you know, we have a responsibility and we really feel that people are thoughtless and careless rather than the companies.
We won't do this to you today, but another aspect of this is regulatory capture. There's only so many experts in a given sector. And when it comes to the government being able to hire people to regulate that sector, there's often so much crossover and so much intentional crossover between private business and government that it becomes very complicated to regulate an industry, because the people responsible for regulating that industry at any given point used to work in the companies or for the companies that they're supposed to now be regulating.
Yeah.
So again, this is, we could really, Eva, you and I could have a lot of fun here, but I don't know how many people in our audience are actually here for that conversation. That one's pretty deep.
I think that the products definitely feel more tangible, but I think that talking about policy and talking about regulation is really critical in fully understanding the commercial determinants of health. So I'm up for it.
So lots more to come, but for now, that's a great place to leave it today here on Living Healthy Together. I'm your host, Philip Rao. Thank you, Eva Zaret, for the fascinating and illuminating conversation. We'll link as many of the scholarly and news resources as possible in the episode description. So if you're listening to the podcast version of this episode, check those out. It won't be light reading, but it will be interesting, it will be troubling, and it will likely leave you with questions of your own. And we'd love to hear them. So reach out to us at healthtalk@uvmhealth.org and share your questions, your thoughts, and your ideas. Tell us whether you want to hear more on emerging topics and research like this. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.